Identity Christians who use the Hebrew name of God, which is Yahweh, rather than the English title Lord, are often assailed as Judaizers, and even told that Yahweh is a Talmudic name, which we learned from Jews only recently. They claim Jews interjected the name Yahweh in the 18th or 19th century. I forget which. It might be, I'm sorry, I probably should have said 19th or 20th century. That's their claim. There is a Jew who pretended to be a Christian, who was probably actually a parallel track to the Hebrew Roots movement, who's called Jacob O. Meyer, I believe. And he has a church called Assembly of Yahweh or House of Yahweh or something like that. And he's been pushing the name Yahweh on denominational Christians for a long time, but everything else he teaches may as well be Jewish. He's just another Judaizer. We don't want to be associated with clowns like that, with devils and deceivers, but we can't help that the God of the Bible, the God of our Savior, Yahshua Christ, that his name is Yahweh. And just because a Jew uses a word isn't going to scare me off of it and tell the truth about that word, ever. I'm not going to surrender one inch of Christian soil, metaphorical or otherwise, to a Jew. But even some supposed identity Christians had adopted this attitude that the use of the name Yahweh is Judaizing. These charges are utterly absurd, and we hope to address that here. We will do this chiefly by presenting an article by Clifton Emmaheiser titled, Which Is It, Lord or Yahweh? This article is credited to Clifton Emmaheiser, who had produced it sometime in the first half of 2006. But Clifton actually only wrote the first paragraph. The balance of the article consists mostly of a lengthy excerpt of an article from Encyclopedia Britannica, and then there are notes in a conclusion which I had written for Clifton at that time. Before we begin, let me say that when I arrived at Clifton's home to move him to Florida in 2017, because he could no longer live by himself, I packed all of his books which I could find, and there were some books missing that I know were missing, and I can't really account for that. Possibly Clifton misplaced them, or possibly because a couple of them were rare. I hate to say it, but I don't want to think poorly of anybody, so I won't. I'll just skip it and leave it at that. So, doing that, Clifton had the set of the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which he mentions here in his paper. But by that time, it was relegated to his basement, probably because the bindings are in very poor condition. Evidently, the 11th edition, which Clifton had, was not as good a quality as the 9th edition. And he had the 9th edition set of Britannica, which dates to 1894, in his living room. So we brought both editions with us and have them both here. The 9th edition is older, but it's in much better condition. The 11th edition is newer, and it's from 1910, and it's falling apart. But the 11th edition had a shorter and more the 9th edition had a, he's quoting the 11th edition here. The 9th edition, which is older, had a shorter and a much more succinct article, which would have probably been better for this paper, I think, in my opinion, because it's without a lot of the errors of the humanists, but it doesn't go into the length of explaining the basis for the use of this name Yahweh that the 11th edition goes into. So Clifton used the 11th edition for this article, and I'm going to make a picture. I made a photograph of the 9th edition, and actually I will include it with this presentation. I'll include a link to it so that you could see that if you so desire. It actually says at the beginning a lot of the same things that this article says from the 11th edition, but it's a lot shorter. So the 9th edition article was only rewritten and lengthened for the 11th edition. The 11th edition article is too long. It was two paragraphs in the 9th edition, and in the 11th edition, it became nearly six full columns in a much larger format. So it was three full pages. I hope I didn't confuse myself again, but I suspect I did. I get confused between these two editions of Clifton's Encyclopedia Britannica because the 11th edition is new and it's falling apart. That's the one we found in Clifton's basement, and it was of poorer quality. And the 9th edition is older, and it's in very good condition, even though Clifton sliced a couple of pages out of it here and there and then to photocopy them and then tuck them back into the books. And I don't know how I could ever repair those, but that's okay. It's only books. So this is Which Is It, Lord or Yahweh by Clifton Emmaheiser. And he only wrote this first paragraph, which I'll read probably without remark. Many today are struggling with this very question. What other subject could be of more importance than the very name of our Creator? Maybe the following article will solve some of your uncertainties. If one wishes to find information on the term Yahweh, it is somewhat hard to find. One reason is because in most encyclopedias, it is listed under Jehovah. Also, in later up-to-date encyclopedias, the information is rather suppressed. The following is rather thorough, but not perfect. A rather thorough, but not perfect article on this subject found in the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, published in 1910. We will not use the entire article, as toward the end they get mired in the errant criticisms of the 1800s humanists. Clifton actually has a few sections with those errant criticisms in here. Otherwise, this article brings to light many historical facts on the topic, but like all testimony, it must be scrutinized. And Clifton's approach was always instead of going back and digging through ancient documents, he always wanted to find things which proved his point in popular Bible commentaries or encyclopedias so that it would give his point more credence or authority, I gather, is why he did that. I mean, I could tell you what an ancient Greek word means, but if I quote a Liddell and Scott or a Joseph Thayer or another lexicon like that on what the word means, then that should have more gravity or more weight to my argument than if I just told you what the word means. So I understand that, but I would rather dig through the ancient documents and quote them. That's my approach, but that's fine. Many of the so-called higher critics of the 19th century were actually Jews who have always been critical of and have sought to undermine Christianity, although many of the higher critics were European humanists, whether they were theologians or not, many of them were humanists, and they followed and accepted most of the traditions of the Jews concerning Christians, so that theologically they were little different than Jews. And yes, theologians can be humanists. Many theologians from the Reformation period and later were humanists. Now, today, I think they're all humanists. Erasmus was one of the earliest famous humanist theologians. Now to proceed with the article from Britannica. Jehovah, and then they have in parentheses, Yahweh. In the Bible, the God of Israel. Jehovah is a modern mispronunciation of the Hebrew name, resulting from combining the consonants of that name, and they have J-H-V-H. They're using the letter J for the Yod, where we would want to write a Y. And I'll address the V, because a lot of people would rather write Y-H-W-H. I'll address that. I do address that in the closing notes here. So it'll be a while. So just suffer it. With the vowels, they want to combine the consonants, which are the Hebrew letters, J-H-V-H, with the vowels of the word Adonai. Now, of course, even the word Adonai doesn't really have vowels in Hebrew, but it's written in vowels in Greek or in English. So Adonai means Lord, which the Jews substituted for the proper name in reading the scriptures. The Jews wouldn't say the word Yahweh. They would say the word Adonai where they read the word Yahweh. And Adon or Adonai means Lord or Master. Continuing. In such cases of substitution, the vowels of the word which is to be read are written in the Hebrew text with the consonants of the word which is not to be read. The consonants of the word are to be substituted. The word to be substituted are ordinarily written in the margin. But inasmuch as Adonai was a regular reading instead of the ineffable name Yahweh, and that's how I'm going to pronounce the tetragrammaton throughout this presentation, it was deemed unnecessary to note the fact at every occurrence. When Christian scholars began to study the Old Testament in Hebrew, if they were ignorant of this general rule or regarded the substitution as a piece of Jewish superstition, which they certainly had a right to regard, reading what actually stood in the text, they would inevitably pronounce the name Jehovah, J-H-V-H or Y-H-V-H, with the vowels from Adonai stuck in between the consonants. It is an unprofitable inquiry. Who first made this blunder? Probably many fell into it independently. The statement still commonly repeated that it originated with Petrus Gallatinus in 1518 is erroneous. Jehovah occurs in manuscripts at least as early as the 14th century. And there's a footnote where the editors had Yahweh in parentheses at the introduction to the article and in the second word of the article, which says that this form, Yahweh, as the correct one, spelling Yahweh the way I do at Christogenia, is generally used in the separate articles throughout this work, other articles relating to Yahweh. So the Encyclopedia Britannica, in other words, in other articles, didn't use the word Jehovah. They used the word Yahweh in separate articles throughout their work in 1910. The Oxford Languages Dictionary defines ineffable, as they say here, that the Jews considered the word Yahweh to be ineffable. Oxford Dictionary defines the word as too great or extreme to be expressed or described in words, and secondly, as not to be uttered, not to be spoken. Then an example of the use of the word is provided, which says, and this is from the Oxford Languages Dictionary, and this is just an example, and they write, the ineffable Hebrew name that Gentiles write as Jehovah. However, there is nowhere in Scripture which prohibits the use of the name Yahweh, except in vain. Rather, in the 1st century AD, Flavius Josephus wrote in Book 2 of his Antiquities of the Judeans, paragraph 276, or line 276, if you will, speaking of Moses, that God declared to him his holy name, which had never been revealed to men before, concerning which it is not lawful for me to say any more. Any more. It is not lawful for me to say any more. So what caused that? And that's going to be part of the investigation here this evening. That statement by Josephus implies that at one time it was lawful for him to say the name, but that it had been prohibited. It was very likely prohibited throughout Judea, even before the ministry of Christ. It did appear in the Dead Sea Scrolls, even in place of Kyrios, in the Greek manuscripts of the Old Testament, which have been found among the scrolls. The authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls, though, I believe, and I have every reason to believe, and I have demonstrated this in other presentations, they were dissidents. They were the fourth sect of Judaism, founded by Judas the Galilean, which Josephus also mentions. Continuing with Britannica. The form Jehovah was used in the 16th century by many authors, both Catholic and Protestant, and in the 17th was zealously defended by Fuller, Gattaker, Lewesdon, and others. I suppose these are all medieval or even Reformation theologians, against the criticisms of such scholars as Drusius, Capellus, and the elder Buxtorf. It appeared in the English Bible in Tyndale's translation of the Pentateuch, 1530, and is found in all Protestant versions of the 16th century except that of Coverdale, which was 1535. In the Authorized Version of 1611, it occurs in Exodus chapter 6, verse 3, Psalm chapter 83, verse 18, Isaiah chapter 12, verse 2, and chapter 26, verse 4, beside the compound names Jehovah Jireh, Jehovah Nissi, and Jehovah Shalom. Elsewhere, in accordance with the usage of the ancient versions, Jehovah is represented by Lord, distinguished by capitals from the title Lord, the Hebrew word Adonai. In other words, when you're reading the King James Bible and you see Lord in all capitals, you know that stands for Yahweh. Now, sometimes, on occasion, you'll see God in all capitals, and that only happens where Adonai, where Adonai appears next to it on rare occasion. So they wrote, Yahweh is God, and put it in all capitals, Lord God. In the Revised Version of 1885, Jehovah is retained in the places which it stood in the AV, the Authorized Version, the King James Version of 1611, and is introduced also in Exodus chapter 6, verses 2, 6, 7, and 8, Psalm 68:20, Isaiah 49:14, Jeremiah 16:21, and Habakkuk 3:19. And I know this is tedious because we're not going through these citations, but it will all be in the notes for you to look them up if you so desire. The American committee which cooperated in the revision desired to employ the name Jehovah wherever J-H-V-H or Y-H-V-H or Yod, He, Vav, He, the four Hebrew letters, occurs in the original, and additions embodying their preferences are printed accordingly. So this didn't just come into Christian identity. We didn't make this up, and this debate has been going on in mainstream theological circles, in Christian theological circles, since the 16th century. And the word was used, according to the testimony in this article, since at least the 14th century. And things moved a lot slower back then. So from this, if they had known better, it is obvious that as early as the 16th century, with only a few exceptions, Christians throughout Europe had sought to use the name Yahweh in their translations of Scripture, even if it was in the mistaken form of Jehovah. Coverdale, who did not follow the others, published his Coverdale Bible in 1535, but Coverdale also collaborated on the Geneva Bible, which was published in 1557. The 1611 King James Version was largely based, not entirely, but much of its language, a great majority of its language, actually, was based on the Geneva Bible. Returning to Britannica, we cannot be certain that it is correct or it gives a time frame for when the Judeans had ceased to use the name Yahweh. In our opinion, it most likely was not restricted until at least the time of the first Herod, since, as we have explained, the name is found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, whose authors were outlaws since the time of the first Herod. Several centuries, continuing with Britannica, several centuries before the Christian era, the name Yahweh had ceased to be commonly used by the Jews. I can't be certain that's correct, but I dispute with it. Let's put it that way. Some of the later writers in the Old Testament employ the appellative. Now, they're going to be dishonest here, and I'm going to refute this and disprove it, but I have to read it. Some of the later writers in the Old Testament employ the appellative Elohim, God, prevailingly or exclusively. A collection of psalms from Psalm 42 through 83 was revised by an editor who changed the Yahweh of the authors into Elohim. That doesn't mean that that happened in ancient times. And they refer to specific of those psalms. But, for example, they only gave four examples, which is not a lot. They go on and say, and I didn't check the veracity of what they said about the psalms, but we'll see that I checked the veracity of quite a few of their other statements here, and they proved to be false. Observe also the frequency of the Most High, the God of heaven, King of heaven in Daniel, and of heaven in 1 Maccabees. The oldest Greek versions. Now, 1 Maccabees, I'm not even going to get into because no surviving Hebrew copy exists, so it's ridiculous to use it as an example here. There are no surviving Hebrew copies of 1 Maccabees, so that's dishonest. The oldest Greek versions, Septuagint, from the 3rd century BC, consistently use Kyrios, Lord, where the Hebrew has Yahweh. Now, the oldest surviving fragments of the Greek, as far as I know, are the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they don't use Lord, they use Kyrios. So that's a lie, but it's not in my notes. I don't have it in my notes. I didn't think to even address that, because it's speaking of Greek manuscripts and not of Hebrew, so that's meaningless in this respect. Going on, they say that that is corresponding to the substitution of Adonai for Yahweh in reading the original. In books written in Greek in this period, as in the New Testament, Kyrios takes the place of the name of God. Josephus, who as a priest knew the pronunciation of the name, declares that religion forbids him to divulge it. Philo calls it ineffable and says that it is lawful for those only whose ears and tongues are purified by wisdom to hear and utter it in a holy place. That is, for priests in the temple. And in another passage, commenting on Leviticus 24:15, if anyone, I do not say, should blaspheme against the Lord of men and gods, but should even dare to utter his name unseasonably, let him expect the death penalty, the penalty of death, and They offer some citations here, but that those words are not found in Josephus. And I can't speak for Philo, but I don't care about Philo. He's a Jew. He's an apostate. And during the first century, he was writing in Alexandria in Egypt. They say the Palestinian authorities more correctly interpreted Leviticus 24:15, not of the mere utterance of the name, but of the use of the name of God in blaspheming God. And as I said, this paragraph is a complete mischaracterization, where it is claimed that the later Old Testament writers ceased to use the name of Yahweh. It can be established that Malachi was the last prophet and the last book of the canonical Old Testament. In the words of that prophet, the name Yahweh is found 38 times in a Masoretic text. Haggai and Zechariah were prophets at the time of the post-Babylonian return to Jerusalem. And in those books, the name is found 25 and 120 times, respectively. Where we must add that Haggai and Malachi are much shorter books than Zechariah. It's found 38 times in Malachi, 25 times in Haggai, in a very short book, and Malachi is awfully short also. And in the much longer Zechariah, it's found 120 times, like 12 or 14 times in chapter 1 alone. In Daniel, who is cited here in support of this misleading argument, and Daniel, I should say, in the earlier prophet Daniel, because he's somewhat earlier than Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, the name Yahweh appears only 7 times, but it appears 7 times. Much of Daniel's interaction is with pagans, with whom he should not have shared the name of Yahweh, and he didn't. That's why he used those titles, because he's speaking to Nebuchadnezzar, or to Belshazzar, or somebody other than a fellow Hebrew, a fellow Israelite. Daniel's speaking to these pagan strangers. So he used terms that the pagan strangers would understand, like the God of heaven or the King of heaven. That's totally natural for the time and place in which Daniel had prophesied. But he used the name of Yahweh 7 times. So their entire argument here that this name was forbidden centuries before the first century is just a lie. It falls apart. It's ridiculous. It's patently false. The author cited the restriction described by Josephus, which we've already read, but it is certainly not relevant to several centuries before the Christian era, as Josephus used himself and not his nation in reference to the restriction. He didn't say that it was a word or a name that the nation was once allowed to say. He said it was a nation, a word that he was, that was once lawful for him to say. He didn't say anything about the nation, so he used that relative to his own time only, that he could once say it, but was no longer allowed to. Philo may have called the name ineffable, but he was born during the rule of the first Herod, and he wrote in Alexandria in Egypt until about 50 AD, which supports our assertion concerning when the name was prohibited. It was prohibited by Edomite Jewish authorities, and certainly not by the earlier Israelite high priests. There's no Hebrew literature that's canonical or in the Apocrypha, which actually survived in Hebrew copies from any time between Malachi and the time of Christ. All of the apocryphal literature only survived in Greek copies from that period. So once again, continuing with Britannica. Various motives may have concurred to bring about the suppression of the name. An instinctive feeling that a proper name for God implicitly recognizes the existence of other gods may have had some influence. Reverence and the fear lest the holy name should be profaned among the heathen were potent reasons. But probably the most cogent motive was the desire to prevent the abuse of the name in magic. If so, the secrecy had the opposite effect. The name of the God of the Jew was one of the great names in magic, heathen as well as Jewish, and miraculous efficacy was attributed to the mere utterance of it. And we would assert that if a generic term is used, such as God or Lord, it serves to facilitate a multiracial society, such as what Judea had become by the time of Christ. With the incorporation of the Edomites and other Canaanites and the forced conversions, which happened from about 125 BC to about 80 BC, chiefly during the tenures of John Hyrcanus and Alexander Janneus as high priests, Judea became a pluralistic society. And once Herod the Edomite became king, that society was ruled by Edomites until after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. If I say God in the presence of a Buddhist, a Judeo-Christian, and a Muslim, the word will evoke a different God in the mind of each listener. The same is true of the title Lord. As the Buddhists even call their idol Krishna their Lord, Lord Krishna. So if I say Lord, the Lord to a Buddhist will think that I'm referencing Krishna. But if I say Yahweh, I am speaking specifically of the God of Israel, the God of the Old Testament. And Buddhists, Judeo-Christians, Muslims, and especially Jews can all be offended. As an identity Christian, that is what I would rather do. I would rather offend heretics and drive away the outsiders. And they could all just go to hell. I'm going to use the name Yahweh because that's the name of my God. I'm not going to leave room to make Jews, Buddhists, Judeo-Christians, Muslims, and all of the other scum of the earth happy or comfortable. No, I'm not going to do that. Returning to Britannica once again. In the liturgy of the temple, the name was pronounced in the priestly benediction. After they're citing Numbers chapter 6. After the regular daily sacrifice in the synagogues, a substitute, probably Adonai, was employed. Now let me say that for this paragraph and the following one, they only give citations from the Talmud. Imagine that. On the Day of Atonement, the high priest uttered the name 10 times in his prayers and benediction. In the last generations before the fall of Jerusalem, however, it was pronounced in a low tone so that the sounds were lost in the chant of the priests. Why wouldn't the Jews want to suppress the name of Yahweh? The tradition that the utterance of the name in a daily benediction ceased with the death of Simeon the Just, 2 centuries or more before the Christian era, perhaps arose from a misunderstanding of a passage in the Talmud. In any case, it cannot stand against the testimony of older and more authoritative texts. And as we have demonstrated, those texts do not uphold their argument. Evidently, Simeon the Just is a reference to the high priest of the late 4th century BC. Simeon, the son of Onias, the son of Jaddua, who had met Alexander the Great at the gates of Jerusalem. But the citations from the Talmud are from 500 years or more later and have no authority on their own. In fact, all of the supporting citations for the statements in this paragraph and the one which follows are from the Talmud, and therefore we should discard them all as Jewish fable and hearsay. So again, returning to Britannica. After the destruction of the temple, the liturgical use of the name ceased, but the tradition was perpetuated in the schools of the rabbis. It was certainly known in Babylonia in the later part of the 4th century, and not improbably much later. Nor was the knowledge confined to these pious circles. The name continued to be employed by healers, exorcists, and magicians, and has been preserved in many places in magical papyri. The vehemence with which the utterance of the name is denounced in the Mishnah, "He who pronounces the name with its own letters has no part in the world to come," now that I do believe is in the Talmud, suggests that this misuse of the name was not uncommon among the Jews. The Samaritans, who otherwise shared the scruples of the Jews about the utterance of the name, seem to have used it in judicial oaths to the scandal of the rabbis. And we would expect the Jews to despise and therefore to look for ways to avoid and ultimately prohibit the use of the name. So none of that paragraph citing the Talmud even surprises me. I would expect that. They do the same thing today. Continuing. The early Christian scholars who inquired what was the true name of the God of the Old Testament had therefore no great difficulty in getting the information they sought. I really don't think it was that much of a secret that they had to seek it. Britannica is only assuming that they were seeking it. Clement of Alexandria, who died in 212, says that it was pronounced Yahweh. That's I-A-O-U-E in Greek letters. Five vowels. Epiphanius, who died in 404, who was born in Palestine and spent a considerable part of his life there, gives Yahweh, I-A-B-E, and I will explain how that difference comes about. But in one codex, it's Yahweh, I-A-U-E, which is how I would probably spell it in Greek. Theodore, who died in 457, born in Antioch, writes that the Samaritans pronounced the name Yahweh, I-A-B-E. In another passage, Yabahi, I-A-B-A-I, the Jews, Ahia, A-I-A, and they are correct with a next state, that the later is probably not Yahweh. And it's not, but it's Ayah. They cite Exodus 3:14, which the Jews counted among the names of God. There is no reason whatever to imagine that the Samaritans pronounced the name Yahweh differently from the Jews. But of course, the Jews weren't using the pronunciation. They wouldn't pronounce it unless they were being disloyal to their rabbis. Continuing again with Britannica. This direct testimony, supplemented by that of the magical texts, in which Yahweh Zebuth, Yahweh or Yahweh Sabbath, as well as Yaba, I-A-B-A, occurs frequently. In an Ethiopic list of magical names of Jesus, purporting to have been taught to him by his disciples, which of course is bullshit, Yahweh is found. Finally, there is evidence from more than one source that the modern Samaritan priests pronounced the name Yahweh or Yahwah, Y-A-H-W-A they have. Variants, Yahweh, Greek, two words, Yahweh, in certain codexes. They don't make clear how those variants are used. They're only listing variants and giving a citation, a list of citations of ancient writings, not too ancient, writings that all are from the Christian era, they probably give about four or five of them here. And they say that Ahiah, which is not the name of Yahweh from Exodus 3:14, occurs also in the great magical papyrus of Paris, and that's medieval, and in the Leyden papyrus, another medieval papyrus. And they give some citations here that I won't repeat. They will all be in the notes. And here I must interject that I have seen the citations referenced here from the Greek of these early Christian writers. Clement of Alexandria lived from about 150 to 215 AD. Epiphanius from about 310 or 320 to 403 AD. With their testimony alone, the claim that Identity Christians learned the name Yahweh from Jews is proven to be utterly ridiculous. We shall discuss their pronunciations further on. Returning to Britannica once again, for our purposes here, I will pronounce the leading J properly as a leading Y, because it occurs often in this next portion of this article. There is no reason to impugn the soundness of this substantially consentient, meaning it all agrees, testimony to the pronunciation Yahweh, or Yahweh with a J, coming as it does through several independent channels. I should say, or Yahweh, Yahweh or Yahweh, but they spell the Yahweh with a J. Coming as it does through several independent channels. Now, they use that Yahweh in order to account for those Greek sources which used a B instead of a U in Yahweh. And I will explain that before we finish this evening. It is confirmed by grammatical considerations. The name Yahweh enters into the composition of many proper names of persons in the Old Testament. And there they had the tetragrammaton as they represent it, J-H-V-H. Either as the initial element or in the form, Jeho or Yeho or Yo, J-O, Yo, as in Jehoram or Joram, or properly Yehoram or Yoram. Or as the final element in the form Yahu or Yah, as in Adoniyahu or Adoniyah. Some people might pronounce that Adonijah. These various forms are perfectly regular. If the divine name was Yahweh, and that's absolutely true, and it's absolutely obvious when you look at all the names in the Old Testament. And taken altogether, they cannot be explained on any other hypothesis. And that's an excellent conclusion. This article, even though it has its faults concerning the disuse of the name, it has a lot of excellent sources and conclusions. Recent scholars, accordingly, with but few exceptions, are agreed that the ancient pronunciation of the name was Yahweh, the way we spell it in Christian Identity. The first H sounded at the end of the syllable. Genebrardus, a late medieval or early modern theologian, Genebrardus seems to have been the first to suggest the pronunciation Yahweh. That's I-A-H-U-E. But it was not until the 19th century that it became generally accepted. And here I will only note that in my own notes in conclusion to this article, which we shall be present below, I explain in other ways how we may understand how to pronounce the tetragrammaton, which is Yahweh. Continuing the article, and there's still quite a bit more. Yahweh, or Yahweh, is apparently an example of a common type of Hebrew proper names which have the form of the third person singular of the verb. And they give a list of examples. Yabneh, the name of a city. Yabin, Yamlek, Yiptah, or Yiptah, which is commonly pronounced Jephthah. Most of these really are verbs. The suppressed or implicit subject being El, Numen, God, or the name of a god. Yabna and Yabna El, Jifna and Jifna El, and are giving further examples. The ancient explanations of the name proceed from the name Yahweh. Proceed from Exodus chapter 3, verses 14 and 15, where Yahweh hath sent me in verse 15. Corresponds to Ayah hath sent me in verse 14, thus seeming to connect the name Yahweh with the Hebrew verb Haya, to become or to be. The Palestinian interpreters found in this the promise that God would be with his people. In future oppressions, as he was in the present distress, or the assertion of his eternity, or eternal constancy. The Alexandrian translation, and I will read it, but I will also translate it, ego eimi, that's I am, and that's actually, ego is a way to say I, and eimi is the way to say I am properly, but ego eimi is emphatic, and that's a phrase that Christ often used of himself in the New Testament, and that Yahweh often used of himself, especially in the prophets, especially in Isaiah. So, ego eimi, I am, ho, which is a singular masculine definite pronoun, own. And own is a form of eimi, but it's a singular masculine participle, which means he being, first person singular masculine participle, he being. So it's translated as I am he who is, ego eimi ho on. And then there's a short ellipsis because they're only showing the meaning of this, the Greek, how this passage in Hebrew from Exodus was translated into Greek. So it continues, ho on, which is, once again, he who is, apostalken me pros humas, which is first person singular, sent me to you. Ho on, apostalken me pros humas. So it's ego eimi ho on, I am he who is. And then later on we read, ho on apostalken me pros humas, he who is sent me to you. So they're saying of that Alexandrian translation, that it understands it in the more metaphysical sense of God's absolute being. And that's the sense that I would understand it in, and I have that in my notes at the end. Both interpretations, he who is always the same, and he who is absolutely the truly existent, import into the name all that they profess to find in it. The one, the religious faith in God's unchanging fidelity to his people. The other, a philosophical conception of absolute being, and then they say, which is foreign both to the meaning of the Hebrew and to the force of the tense employed. And I think that that is not true, and I will contend with that at the end this evening, which I did in my original notes for Clifton. Modern scholars have sometimes found the name the expression of the aseity of God, and aseity is from the Latin word aseitas, a scholastic Latin expression for the quality of existing by oneself, and I would agree with that also. Sometimes of his reality, in contrast to the imaginary gods of the heathen, and I would agree with that also, and they're disputing with this, but I'm agreeing with it. Another explanation, which appears first in Jewish authors of the Middle Ages and has found wide acceptance in recent times, derives the name from the causative of the verb, he who causes things to be, and I disagree with that, gives them being. I mean, it's true of God, but I disagree that his name means that, let's put it that way. Or calls events into existence, brings them to pass with many individual modifications of interpretation, creator, life-giver, fulfiller of promises. A serious objection to this theory in every form is that the verb haya, to be, has no causative stem in Hebrew. To express the ideas which these scholars find in the name Yahweh, the language employs altogether different verbs. This assumption, that Yahweh is derived from the verb to be, as seems to be implied in Exodus 3:14 and after, is not, however, free from difficulty. To be in the Hebrew of the Old Testament is not Hawa, as the derivation would require, but Haya, H-A-Vav-A-H. So that's He-Vav-H in Hebrew. But the word to be, they're saying, is He-Yad-He in Hebrew, H-A-Y-A-H. And we are thus driven to the further assumption that Hawa belongs to an earlier stage of the language, and I would agree with that, or to some older speech of the forefathers of the Israelites. That would be where an earlier stage of the language came from. This hypothesis is not intrinsically improbable, and in Aramaic, a language closely related to Hebrew, to be actually is Hawa, we'll imagine that. But it should be noted that in adopting it, we admit that using the name Hebrew in the historical sense, Yahweh is not a Hebrew name. Big deal. And inasmuch as nowhere in the Old Testament outside of Exodus 3 is there the slightest indication that the Israelites connected the name of their God with the idea of being in any sense, that's a lie because it's all throughout Isaiah, it may fairly be questioned whether, if the author of Exodus 3:14 intended to give an etymological interpretation of the name Yahweh, his etymology is any better than many other paronomastic explanations of proper names in the Old Testament, or than, say, the connection of the name Apollon with Apolluon, the name Apollyon, the name of the destroyer, with Apolluon, the Greek word which means to destroy, in Plato's Cratylus, or the popular derivation from Apollumi. The critical difficulties of these verses need not be discussed here. The divine name in Exodus 3:14, Journal of Biblical Literature, is the article that they're citing. In response to this, I will only say that there is considerable confusion in Hebrew manuscripts in the letters Yod or Y and Vav or Va or V or W, and we want to investigate further in reference to this debate over Haya and Hawa. But returning to Britannica, a root, Hawa, is represented in Hebrew by the nouns Hawa and Hawa, which is double Vav, I guess. Possibly, or maybe with some fancy rabbinical vowel points indicating a double vav, and I usually ignore them in my own transliterations. But if you look at Strong's Concordance, and a lot of his transliterations of Hebrew words, and this isn't in my notes, it's just in my experience, you'll find that Strong's doubled a lot of consonants where the actual Hebrew word doesn't have a double. And sometimes I suspect that the vowel points indicate a double consonant, but I don't care about the vowel points. I would want to erase them all. If I could erase every vowel point from Hebrew, I would do it tomorrow and figure it out for myself, for real. Because the vowel points are a product of the rabbinical mind. And everything else I've ever seen come out of the rabbinical mind is complete sewerage. So I don't want anything from the Jews. That being said, a root, Hawa, single vav, is represented in Hebrew by the nouns Hawa. And that's just a vowel point. That's the difference in a vowel point by a rabbi. And Hawa, a double vav, which is probably also a vowel point by a rabbi, and means disaster, calamity, or ruin. The primary meaning is probably sink down or fall, in which sense, common in Arabic, the verb appears in Job chapter 37, verse 6, of snow falling to earth. A Catholic commentator on the 16th century, Hieronymus ab Oleastro, seems to have been the first to connect the name Jehovah with Hoa, interpreting it, and this is in Latin, which I don't really get the meaning of here, because sometimes I could read it, but often I can't. Contritio sive pernicis. In reference to the destruction of the Egyptians and Canaanites. Dahmer, adopting the same etymology, took it in a more general sense, Yahweh, as well as Shaddai, meaning destroyer, and fitly expressed the nature of the terrible god whom he identified with Moloch. So Yahweh is Moloch, I guess. I mean, some of these medieval Jews and other commentators were just sick. The derivation of Yahweh from Hawa is formally unimpeachable and is adopted by many recent scholars, who proceed, however, from the primary sense of the root rather than from the specific meaning of the nouns. The name is accordingly interpreted, he who falls, and they actually give a Greek word here for a meteorite, or causes rain or lightning to fall, and they have a storm god in parentheses, or cast down his foes by his thunderbolts, like Yahweh is Zeus or something. It is obvious that if the derivation be correct, the significance of the name, which in itself denotes only he falls or he fells, must be learned, if at all, from early Israelitish conceptions of the nature of Yahweh, rather than from etymology. And here the humanists at Britannica are endeavoring to reduce the name of Yahweh to a reference to a typical storm god, or maybe even one of their Nephilim, which we would reject. Their own explanation of the Aramaic form of the verb and the confusion between Hawa and Haya, among other things which are evident here, reveal that the derivation from Hawa, as they define it, is not formally unimpeachable. We will continue with the article. A more fundamental question is whether the name Yahweh originated among the Israelites or was adopted by them from some other people and speech. So Moses is a liar, right? The biblical author of the History of the Sacred Institutions, now here they really betray their humanist persuasion. The biblical author of the Sacred Institutions, identified as P in brackets, expressly declares that the name Yahweh was unknown to the patriarchs, and a much older Israelite historian, with E in brackets, records the first revelation of the name to Moses, citing Exodus 3, verses 13 to 15. Apparently following a tradition according to which the Israelites had not been worshippers of Yahweh before the time of Moses, or, as he conceived it, had not worshipped the God of their fathers under that name. The revelation of the name to Moses was made at a mountain sacred to Yahweh, the mountain of God, far to the south of Palestine, in a region where the forefathers of the Israelites had never roamed, and in the territory of other tribes. And long after the settlement in Canaan, this region continued to be regarded as the abode of Yahweh. And we shall interrupt the paragraph here to say that many of these arguments are grounded in an incomplete view of the facts of ancient biblical history. And even worse, the authors of the study accept the lies of the critics, which claim that the writings of Moses in the Pentateuch are a compilation of diverse sources, one which is identified as the biblical author of the History of the Sacred Institutions, called P, and the other as the much older Israelite historian called E. This entire assessment of the work of Moses is false, and it is based on Jewish and humanist conjecture and lies, which have no real basis in reality. They imagine that they could go through Moses, the works of Moses, and pick through it and decide that this verse or this passage was written by some historian, and this passage was written by some author of the History of the Sacred Institutions, and it's all pure bunk. Speak about the devil contending over the body of Moses, and there it is, right there. That's it. So once again, continuing with Britannica, there is now an attempt to discredit Moses as a purveyor of some religion of the Midianites, which later scriptures clearly disprove. Moses is closely connected with the tribes in the vicinity of the Holy Mountain. According to one account, he married a daughter of the priest of Midian. To this mountain he led Israelites after their deliverance from Egypt. There his father-in-law met him, and extolling Yahweh as greater than all the gods, offered in his, and they have it, a question in parentheses, in his capacity as priest of the place, sacrifices at which the chief men of the Israelites were his guests. There the religion of Yahweh was revealed through Moses, and the Israelites pledged themselves to serve God according to its prescriptions. It appears, therefore, that in the tradition followed by the Israelite historian that they invent, the tribes within whose pasture lands the mountain of God stood were the worshippers of Yahweh before the time of Moses. And they surmise that the name Yahweh belongs to their speech rather than to that of Israel, has considered probability, the surmise, the guess that the name of Yahweh belongs to their speech, meaning the Midianites, has considerable probability, which is a lie, and there's no basis for that. One of these tribes was Midian, in whose land the mountain of God lay. The Kenites also, with whom another tradition connects Moses, and that's just a lie also, seem to have been worshippers of Yahweh, which is a lie also. It is probable that Yahweh was at one time worshipped by various tribes south of Palestine, and that several places in that wide territory, Horeb, Sinai, Kadesh, etc., were sacred to him. The oldest and most famous of these, the Mountain of God, seems to have lain in Arabia, east of the Red Sea. From some of these peoples, and at one of these holy places, a group of Israelite tribes adopted the religion of Yahweh, the God who, by the hand of Moses, had delivered them from Egypt. And then they write in their footnote of a divergent Judean tradition, probably belonging to the Talmud or something, who knows, according to which the forefathers had worshipped Yahweh from time immemorial, may indicate that Judah and the kindred clans had in fact been worshippers of Yahweh before the time of Moses. But that's not really possible, because Moses was only a third generation Israelite from when Jacob went down to Egypt. Kohath, it's Levi, Kohath, Amram, Moses. Moses is born in the third generation. Judah went to Egypt with Levi and Jacob. When did Judah worship Yahweh independently from Levi? So that's just crazy. So that divergent Judean tradition. These Encyclopedia Britannica authors or editors are very much representative of most of what happened to Christian academia, Christian scholars, with the age of humanism. They're so far departed from history and scripture that they just spout trash from their mouths without even considering what they're saying. It's pretty much incredible. Now, this bit about the Kenites takes advantage of what I see as a mistranslation in all the way in the book of Judges, I believe, where Eber the Kenite is mentioned in relation to Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses. But in that mistranslation, it's very clear that Eber the Kenite, that the word Kenite doesn't refer to a tribe in reference to Eber. It's in Judges chapters 4 and 5. Rather, it refers to his vocation. And the context in those chapters, Judges chapters 4 and 5, will prove that, because the wife of Eber the Kenite killed Sisera, the general of the Canaanites, with a hammer and a nail, with a single blow from a hammer and a nail. Eber wasn't a Kenite, he was a smith, which Kenite may also mean, and he was a smith, and that's how his wife was so damn good with that hammer and nail, nailing that general to the dirt on the first shot. Women can't do that. Most men can't do that unless they're practiced with a hammer and nail. Okay. Well, the name of Yahweh certainly may have been known to men before the time of Abraham. To Abraham himself, it was not revealed. And I'm saying it's very possible it was known to men. There are indications of that in ancient inscriptions, which can't be explained otherwise. But that's fine, because I'm sure it could very well have been known to Adam and to Noah and to Enoch and others of the patriarchs. But Moses was only six generations from Abraham, and the name was not revealed to Abraham himself. Abraham's fathers were pagans, as we read in, I believe it's in Joshua chapter 24 or chapter 25, that Abraham's immediate ancestors were pagans. But Moses was only six generations from Abraham, the line being Isaac, Jacob, Levi, Kohath, Amram, and Moses. And Moses' father-in-law was probably closer to Abraham in descent than that, having been older than Moses, and having his descent from Abraham's later wife, Keturah. The Midianites came from Abraham, so why wouldn't they have the same God that Abraham did and simply not know his name? The fact that Moses' father-in-law was a descendant of Abraham through Midian shows that Moses and his father-in-law shared a common heritage and faith up to the time when Yahweh revealed himself to Moses. That does not mean that the name of God that they had both worshipped, Yahweh, had revealed his name to anyone of the line of Abraham before the time of Moses. So that they're totally misrepresenting scriptural history. Returning to Britannica for one more paragraph. Now they fail to admit connections that they should have made, but all along it is clear that the editors had been following Jews. So they say, the attempts to connect the name Yahweh with that of an Indo-European deity, Jehovah Jove, etc., Jehovah, Jove. They have it as a dash. It should be Jehovah, comma, Jove, etc. Or to derive it from Egyptian or Chinese may be passed over. Now, I would certainly agree with the Egyptian and the Chinese. But one theory which has considerable currency requires notice. Namely that Yahweh or Yahu, Yaho, is the name of a god worshipped throughout the whole or a great part of the area occupied by the Western Semites. In its earlier form, this opinion rested chiefly on certain misrepresented testimonies in Greek authors about a god, Yeho, and was conclusively refuted by Bardason. Now, I understand the god Yo and similar spellings in early Greek texts, but there were no Greek texts before the 7th century BC, so that's 800 years after Moses. They really mean nothing to me. The name was spread throughout the Mediterranean by the Phoenicians, and I'm sure the Danann and Dorian Greeks as well. Recent adherents of the theory build more largely on the occurrence in various parts of this territory of proper names of persons and places, which they explain as compounds of Yahu or Yah. The explanation is in most cases simply an assumption of the point at issue. Some of the names have been misread. Others are undoubtedly the names of Jews, and Clifton has sick Israelites. That should say Israelites, not Jews. There remain, however, some cases in which it is highly probable that names of non-Israelites, funny how they didn't say non-Jews, are really compounded with Yahweh. The most conspicuous of these is the king of Hamath, who in inscriptions of Sargon, 722 to 705 BC, is called Yabidi and Ilubidi. Yahubidi and Ilubidi. And they have in parentheses compare Jehoiakim and Eliakim. And that's true. Eliakim is the same name as Jehoiakim, but one of them has Yaho or Yahweh at the beginning, and the other one has El or God at the beginning. So that is true. And by that, it's also manifest that Ya-U-B-D and Il-U-B-D are equivalents, one of them having Yahweh and the other one simply having God at the beginning. Azriah of Yadi. Also, in inscriptions of Tiglath-Pileser, 745 to 728 BC, who is formerly supposed to be Azariah or Uzziah of Judah, is probably a king of the country in northern Syria, known to us from the Zengerli inscriptions as Yadi, J-A apostrophe D-I, and I didn't have time to investigate that in time for this evening. I probably have a copy of that inscription, and perhaps one day in the future I might get to that, but I want to do a sequel to this presentation in the next year or so on the accusations that the name Yahweh was found among the Canaanites and others. And these would be part of those accusations, but it's simply not true, and I will explain why. In conclusion, they go on to say that the form Yahu or Yaho occurs not only in composition, but by itself, and they cite certain Aramaic papyri, and say that this is doubtless the original of Yao, frequently found in the Greek authors, and with that I would agree that the Israelites spread the name far and wide during the 800-year period of their kingdom, the Judges period and the period of the kings combined. So they say that Yao is frequently found in Greek authors and in magical texts as the name of the god of the Jews, where Clifton should have once again put sick Israelites. So for our purposes here this morning, I will do that. And they have further citations for that, but they're in German, so I'm not even going to go there. So now in this final paragraph, the authors exhibit the fact that they are ignorant of Syrian history, where it is clear in the historical books of Scripture that from the time of David, the children of Israel and Judah had been in control of Damascus and all the coast of Syria for at least a great portion of the time, from David until the time of Jeroboam II and on to the Assyrian conquest of Israel. So we should expect to see Israelites with such names among the governors of Hamath and other places in Syria, which serves to prove that the historical books of Scripture are true. But in some of their statement in this final paragraph, the authors did correctly indicate the charges, which are also made by the detractors of Christian identity, that Yahweh is really the name of an ancient Canaanite deity, are also wrong. And that is a subject for another time. I can't do that this evening. It's already been well over 2 hours, and we still have another 10 or 15 minutes here. So, now we've been to conclude our presentation with the notes that I had originally written for Clifton. I think this was late 2005 or early 2006. Of course, I stand by them to this day. I wish I could have filled them out more for this presentation. But that took me longer. This much took me longer than I thought it would today, but that's fine. One thing the commentators fail to see in attempting to find the meaning of the name Yahweh is the connection between the Septuagint's ego eimi and the usage of that same phrase by Yahshua Christ describing himself. And we find that in the New Testament in Matthew chapter 14, Mark chapter 10, Mark, John chapter 6, Mark chapter 14, John chapter 4, and I keep citing cross-references to these. I cite a bunch of passages from John and from the Revelation, from chapters 1, 2, and 22. Yahshua used this phrase often, ego eimi, in reference to himself, and often it must have vexed the Jews, who surely must have realized his intention, where he used it as a standalone phrase in the manner that directly connects him with the I am of the scriptures. For example, in Isaiah chapter 43, verses 10 and 11, where Yahweh also said, I am your Redeemer. I am several times in reference to himself. Ego, I me. And actually, to be more clear, this was noted in the article, but the authors denied the connection. I will try not to change the original language I used 17 or 18 years ago when I wrote this for Clifton, but I had to condense this at that time. I had to condense this so that it would fit into the end of one of his pamphlets, and that was a challenge. That was often a challenge. So I said, the opinions given concerning the derivation of the word Yahweh from the verb hawa, matching the Aramaic, are certainly correct. It would be ignorant to think that Hebrew, as the Israelites used it, was the original language of their forebears. Surely both Hebrew and Aramaic had an older common dialect to which the word Yahweh belonged. And here I must interject that I believe Hebrew, as it is known in Scripture, probably developed along with the Hebrew alphabet as a derivative language of what the forefathers of the Israelites may have spoken in Haran, which was in Padaram or Aram Naharaim, in the far north of Mesopotamia, above modern Syria, north of the Euphrates River, in what today is a part of modern Turkey, or in Ur of the Chaldees, a city in ancient Sumer. Since the ancestors, cousins, and uncles of Isaac and Jacob had been called Syrians, for example, of Jacob in Deuteronomy chapter 26, verse 5, and of Laban, his father-in-law, and his mother's brother in Genesis 25, verse 20, that's Laban the Syrian. It is not such a stretch of the imagination to associate the name Yahweh with the Aramaic verb hawa. In the places in which Abraham had lived, men wrote in cuneiform characters and not in Hebrew letters. It is apparent to me, and I'm going back to 2006, I guess, it is apparent to me that the name, which is rather more of a designation of Yahweh, was surely known to the patriarchs before Abraham's time. I should have said perhaps long before Abraham's time. As your article, referring to the Britannica article, goes on to discuss, so it was found among the writings of other branches of our Genesis 10 race. It was only, and surely with his will, lost to the children of Isaac and revealed anew, I should have said, to the ancestors of Abraham, and revealed anew to Moses and the Israelites of the Exodus. The word Baitulos, which has no evident Greek etymology, very much resembles the Hebrew Bethel, Beit being written for Beth as it is in various Septuagint editions. And I had said that in reference to the citation of that word in the article itself. And it was hard writing for Clifton when I had only a very limited space. Clifton would I'd send him these notes and he'd send them back to me and say, you got to reduce this for me by so much. And I'd be cutting sentences out and trying to squeeze it in. And it was difficult sometimes because Clifton wanted to fit this on two sides of an 8.5 by 14 inch piece of paper in 8 columns. And he would only make the font so small. So somewhere up here, there was a reference to that word Baitulos in the article. So I'm sorry, I've lost it. I can't even find it right now. I'm looking. It's really not that important. It's just a peripheral comment for the most part. My thoughts on this today are along the same lines with some variation. They are a subject for another day. Here will suffice to say that there is evidence which seems to support the assertion that in more ancient times the name Yahweh, or some form thereof, was known to men. However, that does not mean that the name had any specifically pagan origin. Neither does that make the words of Moses in Exodus concerning the revelation of the name into a lie, as those words would literally remain true. The Israelites did not have the name. There's nothing in the text in Genesis which indicates that Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob had that name. If one may only pass over an attempt to connect Yahweh to the Indo-European deity Jove, it is only because one is attempting to uphold the falsehoods of Jewish and Israel identity as generally understood. Paul of Tarsus knew better, for which we can refer to Romans chapter 1 from verse 18. Among the languages of Europe, the V, the W, and the U were often interchanged with one another. And actually, in the English language, the V was not distinguished from the U, and the W did not appear until, I think, the 15th century. Maybe the 16th, but I think it's the 15th. They were often, those letters, V, W, and U, interchanged with one another, and in Hebrew, Latin, and Greek, were all represented by the same letter. Also, the V often became a B, which is why we have Yahweh or Yahweh here, because I imagine if a Judean had pronounced Yahweh as Yahweh, then a Greek, having no V sound, and that's a consonant, in Greek would write Yahweh, I-A-B-E instead of I-A-U-E. That's natural. That's not a serious discrepancy at all. They're totally similar words. When you consider that Vav evidently was pronounced as either a U or a W or a V, and scholars make the same argument about Latin. Today, they make the same argument. There was no J in any of these languages, the J being a recent innovation, 15th century. It represents an I or Y in early language. The Latin, when you see a J written in German, it represents an I or a Y. The Latin V being a U, Jove in Latin is Jove, because there's no J, the equivalent of the Greek Yahweh, I-O-V, which is a U. Jove in Latin is Yahweh, the equivalent of the Greek Yahweh. Josephus, in Wars of the Judeans, in Book 5, tells us that the name of Yahweh is in Greek, where that's four consonants in Hebrew. In Greek, it's spelled with four vowels. And he must have had I-O-U-E or I-A-U-E in mind. Any of these are a fair transliteration of Yahweh in Greek. Jove, or Yahweh, is plainly equivalent to Yahweh. It has been discussed that Jupiter, and I cite an article from the Oxford Encyclopedia of the Classical World, that Jupiter is a contraction of the Latin Jove, Pater, and therefore it's equivalent to Yahweh, Father. It seems to me that the early Christian writers may have gone out of their way in avoiding Yahweh in a conscious attempt to avoid connecting Yahweh with Jove, the Latin high god, and probably for fear of the Romans. This is evident in Clement of Alexandria's Yahweh, five vowels, I-A-O-U-E, since he must have known of the testimony of Josephus, who distinctly states that the name could be spelled with four vowels and not five. So the notion that Yahweh was introduced to Christianity by Jews, the notion that the name Yahweh, was introduced to Christianity by Jews in the 19th or 20th centuries is a lie. The Jews have instead done all they could to suppress the name, and they become enraged when it is used by Christians. I've seen that firsthand. And that is for one reason only, that Jews are themselves of the devil, and they are devils. They want you to be devils like them. So that ends our presentation for this evening. I know it wasn't as smooth as I had initially hoped, and it was a lot longer than I initially thought. But praise Yahweh, the God of Israel. Thank you for listening, and good night.